Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, we're heading out east in this week's episode. And, well, I reckon by the time you've heard today's podcast, there are going to be one or two extra things on your to-do list. To find out how to do them, the website you need is Queen Elizabeth Olympic park.co.uk, which of course gives away exactly where we're going today. Yes, we're in the final stages of the much anticipated opening of the Queen Elizabeth Park, and whilst there's lots on offer there, there's really only one way to see it. So from atop Anish Kapoor's Orbit sculpture, it's Friday the 21st of March 2014. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sound. You ain't never seen the light before, just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, step out of me, see things of the air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw, down the road, jam brand store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
All the audio description in the world, it sometimes happens that I regret that we haven't got pictures to directly attach to the sound. I wonder if somebody will invent something that will help with that one day. We have the most amazing view in front of us, and in fact all around us. We are up the ArcelorMittal Tower on the Olympic Park with me, Dr. Philip Askew, and you're responsible for not only turning the park from what it is now into what it's going to become, but also you've been here, Philip, for the last 8 years, and you're in charge of landscaping and so forth. Hello, first of all.
Hello.
What's the story here in terms of what's about to happen on the Queen Elizabeth Park?
So on April the 5th, we'll be opening the remaining part of the park, what we call the South Park, and we have done a lot of work since Games to really make the park this fantastic new facility, this new green open space for London. And in particular, we have turned what was very large areas of paving necessary for Games into a series of gardens, if you like. We've been working with some extraordinary designers and horticulturalists, garden designers, plants people, to create a place which I think will be unique in London, in fact unique in this country, if not the world.
And this episode is going out on the 21st of March, which means that the listener will be just about a fortnight away from the opening date. We're, of course, recording it a week or so earlier. At the moment, we have a delicious early spring sunshine piling in through the windows. I have to say, looking down on the Olympic Park, all I can see is cranes and construction. It seems difficult to believe that this is going to be turned around in time.
Well, I think we're on the wrong side of the orbit, and if we walk around this structure, which of course affords the most fantastic panoramic views, and look down in other parts, we'll see fantastic new events lawns, where during Games we had back-of-house areas and fast food outlets, and then looking north up the Lee Valley and the River Lee, we will see where we've created a series of pleasure gardens. We've got theatre spaces, we've got great play areas, we've got an amphitheatre which will be great for hanging out in and having events in during the summer. We may well have places where we have traditional carousels, so a very active place. 24-hour park, actually. It's not going to be closed at night. People will be able to come in and enjoy it. We also have the most fantastic water feature, which will be great for play, great for kids. drive their parents mad, no doubt. But, you know, I fully expect that on a day like we have today, or indeed in the summer when it's a lot hotter, people will come to this place to have a great family day out.
And that's the 5th of April, I think, the opening of that South Park happens. It seems to me, though, your background, I know, is as a horticulturalist, and a lot of that stuff is really stretching that job description to the limits. How much of the work there have you been overseeing yourself, and how much has been sort of stuff that you've been collaborating on, but somebody else has been really pulling the strings? How does that all fit together for you?
Well, I mean, anything of this scale is all about collaboration and working with other people. And I've been incredibly privileged to work with some of the best designers, some of the best horticulturalists, soil scientists, ecologists, construction teams I can imagine. So my role, going back to that, is really as client. I hold the budget and I hold the program. So I'm responsible, if you like, for getting it built on time. My background, as you say, is in horticulture, but also landscape architecture and urban design. So I'm lucky or unlucky, maybe, in that I can look down a hole in the ground and have a fair idea about what's going on, but also I understand the bigger picture, master planning and urban design, and how really this park and everything that's happening here will really change this part of London and bring new opportunities.
Well, I just know that we're going to find ourselves talking about how far this area has come, and very, very much so under your eye and influence. What about you personally? How far does this bring you, this project, from where you started out?
Well, it's been the most extraordinary experience. And I suppose for me, the joy of working on a project like this is working, as I say, with a great bunch of people, all sorts of experts and designers. And for me, the best thing is I'm learning every day. I continue to learn about things and work with people in a very collaborative way. My journey has been since 2007, 2008, when this whole area was largely inaccessible. In fact, where the Orbit is, where we're standing now, there was a railway goods yard below our feet, very polluted, neck high in a particularly noxious weed called Japanese knotweed, which is renowned for being a real pest. So completely changed this place from an area which was perhaps off limits to many people. Perhaps unless they were doing things they shouldn't be doing. You know, we had the largest fridge mountain in Europe here. We had lots of dumping up north, where the velodrome is, not where we are here, but at the other end of the park. We had the Tottenham Tip, which when I looked down a hole which was 30 foot deep and saw a Victorian street at the bottom, you realised that everything above it was rubbish from over a century ago. So archaeologically...
No, I can't let us move on so fast from that one. You looked down a hole and saw a Victorian street.
Absolutely. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, in the many ways, you know, of course, the East End of London and this part of London has been very significant to the sort of the industry of the area. So this whole part of London was used by very early industries. We had, I think, we had the first dry cleaners in the world not far from here. Going back in time, we had mills and we had salmon smokeries and such like. We still do in some areas. So it's got a very rich history with the River Lea running through the centre of it. And of course the River Lea is also arguably London's second river. It still provides a lot of London's water upriver. So it's fantastic history, but like many areas which have been industrialised for a long time, of course, perhaps in the past people weren't so careful about what they did with some of the waste that they produced. So of course when we started work on the park, we had to spend 2 years cleaning it up. You know, we cleaned over 2 million tonnes of soil in order to make the place safer in the future. We dealt with our Japanese knotweed as well.
Well, each of these missions sounds like a complex and challenging operation in and of itself. I know because by coincidence I realised I worked with the Foreign Office on a video that was going out to other countries about how they cleaned the park up, and what you're talking there about the reclamation of the soil. Just that, what a feat, a cutting-edge process that was going on there. There was a huge emphasis, wasn't there, on making sure that that sustainable processes were used. I think a lot of the transport was done by canal and so forth.
Absolutely, right from the start, for all sorts of reasons, for the right reasons about minimising emissions, minimising taking waste off-site. We did a lot of work. So, for example, the soil that we washed, we cleaned it. We actually had things we called soil hospitals on the park, which were these big bits of kit which helped us clean out and remove some of the worst material. That meant that we could keep over 90% of it on site and use it to form the landscape, to form the topography, if you like, and therefore we didn't need to take it away in lorries or on by rail and fill up holes in the ground somewhere, which of course is the perhaps would have been the traditional route a few years ago. So in that respect, very sustainable. Yes, you're quite right. We took out and we bought in a lot of our materials by rail. We had our own goods yard, which was pre-existing, but we used it specifically for this. And also we built we dredged and built a wharf on the canal so that we could use that as well. So we really tried to use alternative approaches to getting materials in and out, for example.
So going back to that early, to the early days of the park, I could well imagine that you turn up here and you see what needs to be done and you start hacking through like an Amazon explorer or something through all this knotweed. But I was wondering whether particularly the habits of people, you know, people are used to using this place for certain things, dumping fridges or whatever it might be. It's got a reputation as this is where you go fly tipping. I wonder whether those habits are maybe the knotweed on the organic side of things. Do they attempt to make a resurgence? Are you always sort of fighting them back at the edges? Has that all completely changed now?
Well, of course. It's interesting, actually, because we identified early on if we got rid of all of this noxious weed, which was really important to do because it can damage foundations, it can push its way through paths. People have read about people who can't sell houses because they've got Japanese knotweed in their garden, for example. But we also recognised that in the future and in managing the park, of course, the River Lea is a great transporter of material. It's quite interesting when we were building the park and cleaning up the river and waterways, etc. As an example, on a Monday morning, you often got quite a lot of footballs appearing in the river and being washed up because, of course, people were playing football at various places up and down the river over the weekend, and the ball would end up in the river and get swept down. So that was quite an intriguing sort of, slightly apocryphal, but there was an element of truth in its story. But, of course, it can also bring down, you know, seeds and weeds of other sorts. So, again, we have a management process here, which means we just keep an eye on it. And we know that by helping to clean the river, by using some of the sustainable and biodiverse systems to clean the river and the waterways, we are doing other things. We're encouraging habitat, we're encouraging all sorts of mammals, birds, insects to come in. That all helps the process of making this part of London and the waterways here usable for all.
Staying back 7-8 years before we come forward and talk about what's going on here now, as you started your work on the Olympic site, what sort of resources did you have to hand? And I don't know whether we can talk about budgets or not, that might all be top secret, but what sort of person power or what kind of equipment, or was it a case that you said what you needed and went from there?
Well, we had to do a lot of work, and I suppose one of the things which we did was have a lot of, for want of a better term, process in place. So, for example, we wanted, as part of the landscape, to plant a lot of the riverbanks. We wanted to have wetlands very good for biodiversity, but also great to look at, and also helping to clean the waterways up. So we wanted to create biodiversity, habitat, wetlands along as much of the waterways as possible. In order to do that, we actually set up an experiment in the park well in advance. So we actually tried different ways of planting different sorts of plants on the water edge in the northern part of the park before we did any work there at all. And we did that for about 18 months. And that was an invaluable piece of research and study, which actually said there were better ways to do things. What that meant was when we actually came to do the wetland planting, which is quite extraordinary, is that it was very successful. So I like to think that we took some quite significant risks in terms of some of the approaches we did. We believe we built a pretty unique, globally unique park in terms of its aspirations, but we took those risks knowingly by doing some experiments, if you like, some science in the park beforehand. And that was really part of the whole process. It was not about rushing in and starting to, you know, do things willy-nilly, if you like. It was about taking a measured step, using real expertise. You know, in the case of the parklands, we consulted with the National Trust, Forestry Commission, Environment Agency, Natural England, all the people who have the real expertise in various aspects, in order to test our ideas, our designs, and to make them actually function and work in the best possible way.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so it would be, because when you said that you wanted biodiversity here on X Marks the Spot, that's where we want biodiversity. That almost sounded like it. That was a decision that had been passed down or something. But were you involved in deciding that that would be the best approach for that particular area? How far back was your involvement?
A number of different approaches. So before we did any work on the park, we actually studied, for example, we did a study of all of the biodiversity, all the different creatures, the different habitats that existed here. And indeed, what we did is we then actually collected all of the toads, the newts, the things which were sort of living here. We collected them and actually took them off and rehoused them, because otherwise, you know, they'd go underneath bulldozers and all sorts of heavy kit. So we were very careful about recording what we had and about protecting it and taking it away. We also incidentally collected seeds from the plants that were local to here so that we could bring them back later on. So we thought about that very carefully. And then, of course, we had a design team which worked to a brief, which was written by me and others, experts in particular, and they produced a design, and that design was then tested using a range of expertise to make sure that it did a number of things. It had to do all sorts of things. So it had to work for games, it had to work for transformation. And of course, you know, this is the largest new urban park in this country for over a century. So we wanted something which was going to be sustainable, which reflected current concerns, say, about climate change or heavy rainfall and flooding, a growing urban population, but also a place which in 100 years' time would still be here and would be a lot better than it is now, because the great thing about parkland and landscape is, of course, it is that from day one it starts to get better. Very different to a building.
Yes, and we were talking to an expert horticulturalist over at Chiswick House and Gardens just a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the way that somebody involved in gardens and landscape has to think in the dimension of time as well.
Mm. Absolutely, and I think that's what that's what makes landscape, parklands, green spaces in cities so important. We know that green space is good for people. It's good for people's psyche. It's great place to cycle and run and jog and relax in, and as populations grow, as London, we know, is growing fast, these sorts of green spaces will become really important. But also,
can I just jump on that point, actually, because the I know the one of the arguments in sort of social politics over the last 20 years or so has been around the spaces that once were free and public, the town square, for example, have become private spaces, such as, you know, the Westfield Centre might be, I suppose, an example close to hand. What is the ownership and governance of the park going to be as we go forward?
Well, in simple terms, the parklands and indeed the areas around which are being developed are owned by the London Legacy Development Corporation, which is a mayoral development corporation, with its brief really to take on legacy, which of course was the promise of games. That was what it was all about. It's about how can we really used games as a lever to align the quality of people's lives, their aspirations, their educational opportunities, their lives, if you like, with the rest of London. Because the east of London, and I'm sure this is the case in many other cities, has always been the sort of second cousin to the west, if you like. The west has been where the wealth is, the west has been where the development's been. It's a fact that people have lived longer in West London than in East London. So the intention here is really to bring East London up so there's no disparity, if you like, and the games is that big massive lever, which means that we have managed to do things here which otherwise wouldn't have been possible or would have taken a huge amount of time. And on the back of that, now of course we can develop this area, we can provide education, we can provide homes, we can provide jobs, and the park and the opportunities left by games are really the things which lever in that opportunity, if you like. In terms of the park and how it's owned by the LLDC, the London Legacy Development Corporation, managed by us. It's free, it's open all hours, well, certainly the South Park is. The North Park is a much greener, more biodiverse, quieter area, so we will to an extent restrict access at night there. We think that's important and a useful thing to do. But the park is like all other London parks, it's open to all.
Where are the differences? Because I know there may be some, and of course very few parks have quite as much going on here as you already do and plan to have going on. Are there other differences that we might notice?
Well, I think the difference here is that we have, unlike many other parks in London, which are extraordinary It has some of the best parks in the world.
Victoria Park, just a stone's throw.
Victoria Park, not from here, and of course the Royal Parks, the Central London Parks, etc. The difference about with this park is, firstly, of course, it is a product of the Olympic Games, so it has some history there, and of course it has these fantastic venues. It has the Orbit we're in, the stadium, the Aquatic Centre, Copper Box, the Velodrome, etc. So it's a very active park. And then we have a landscape which weaves it and really brings it all together, which makes it a place which is going to be great for people. It connects parts of London which were previously difficult to get across, so it connects east-west, north-south. Ultimately, you'll be able to walk up the Lee Valley, up into the countryside, if you like, and ultimately you'll be able to walk south down towards the River Thames. So fantastic connectivity, which of course makes a big difference to how cities and places work. It has fantastic transport connections now, probably the best in London, really, with Stratford getting better in a few years when Crossrail comes here. But it also, as a park, as a landscape, it thinks about the future. It thinks very much about biodiversity. So, for example, 50% of the parkland, or almost 50% of it, is designed as habitat. Doesn't mean it's exclusive to insects and bees and whatever else might live here, but it has a very different philosophy behind it, which is that in urban areas where there's not a lot of access to green space, it's really important to have ecologically diverse space. So, for example, we have 4 frog ponds in the park. Fantastic things for frogs, not surprisingly, invertebrates, insects, etc., but also great for education, for kids to come here from local schools to learn about the sorts of things that live in them. You know, we have 2 otter halts in the park, so specifically designed for otters. We know there are otters not so far up the Lee Valley near Walthamstow, and we hope that as the water conditions improve, as the opportunities for feeding improve, otters will find their homes down here. So those are just 2 examples of over 700 different wildlife installations around the park for all sorts of birds and creatures.
Could I jump on that with a stupid question?
No.
I know that'll please you. Well, I know there are quite a few nature reserves tucked in around the city, and some of them in quite surprising places, and not so very far off the beaten track either. What are the differences between a small nature reserve and the areas of the park that you've just been talking about there? What are the different principles at play?
Well, I think the main difference, really, for me, is that a nature reserve is what it says on the tin. It's a reserve. It's protected specifically for nature. Access is often allowed, but it's often restricted in some form or another. What we're doing here is having a park which encourages biodiversity in nature. So we want a place that people can really enjoy, can play in, can picnic in, can come and see events in, but also one which works for biodiversity in nature as well. So that people...
Without the scales being tilted too far that way.
Without the scales being tilted too far. But it's really... we think it's really important that these things exist in a dense urban area, and people can come in and enjoy them, because we know that, for example, that there are genuine psychological benefits to green space, and for stressed city workers and livers, these sorts of places are really important for people to come into and to breathe, if you like, and to relax.
We'll come back to talk in much more detail about the landscape and the park and what's down below us, but you're right to remind us that we are up the tower, and it's difficult not to spot the tower from anywhere in East London. I've got to say, while we were talking, I was delighted to notice over your shoulder, because there's work still going on here and there's a few bits of work equipment behind you, there's a Henry the Hoover. Pretty much the last thing I expected to see up the orbit. What do you think of this tower yourself?
It was interesting. I mean, I watched it being built. In fact, when we were building this part, the part before Games, our site compound was just below it, or not far from it. And every day I'd come here and see another bit of red appear and be craned into place. I personally quite like it, but I recognise that in my mind it's a Marmite moment. Some people like it and some people really dislike it, which is fine, you know, of course. I think with these sorts of things, and it is an art piece, if you like, or albeit an observation platform as well, I think with these sorts of things, you need to give them time. I mean, I remember when the Angel of the North was proposed and built many years ago, there was a lot of derision, if you like. A lot of people said, what is this about? And why on earth are we spending all this money? And all sorts of things like that. Now it's seen as a sort of the entrance to that part of the north of England. It's seen as an emblem, as a symbol, if you like. So who knows, maybe this will do the same thing. I think one needs to give it time and see.
We should describe the tower itself. I've been keeping an eye on the thing over the last few years. Wasn't quite sure what I'd expect to find in the drum-like room at the top of it. How far up are we, by the way, do you know?
I think we are... crumbs now. I used to have these sorts of facts etched into my brain. I think we're about 120 metres up. But I could be wrong.
We're looking at some of the publicity here. 114 metres in the... in fact, I was interested in the number of steps. Does it say it on here? Oh, no, it's not on this one. I think it's something like 250-odd steps that bring us up to... In fact, I've got it on that bit of paper. We'll look at that later. it's about 250 steps. We were just trying to find some comparisons. If you wanted to walk up to this observation deck, it's about half of what you'd do if you were putting in the effort at St Paul's Cathedral. But of course, you can come up by elevators here, and they shot us up at high speed. And we've arrived in a deliberately airy room. I think the idea is to create a sense of instability, which is quite an unusual thing to go for at the top of a tower. Could you talk about these mirrored panels? Because these seem particularly unusual to me.
Well, the mirrors are really about... when you come to this... You come out of the lift and you come into this space, you're confronted by this fantastic view over London. You can see Canary Wharf, you can see the Shard, you can see some of the other peculiarly shaped buildings which are appearing in the centre of London. So you get this stupendous panoramic view. But in addition to that, you get these very careful and cleverly designed mirrors which reflect the view in various ways. So, for example, where we're standing and looking out towards Canary Wharf, on both sides of us are these mirrors which actually show the same view but upside down. And then as you move around the mirrors, they are curved and worked in a particular way to give this very peculiar perspective of London and this part of London. And so, for example, as we're walking along here, we were seeing the city upside down, and now we're looking at ourselves in what looks a little bit like a funfair mirror, slightly distorted, quite intriguing and quite interesting.
I feel like I'm seeing myself on a 3D cinema screen.
Yes, it's a bit like one of those sort of giant cinema screens, isn't it? And quite interesting. And as we carry on walking round and look back again, we'll get more views of the city and of places. And the idea is that...
We've got a view of Henry again.
We've now got a view of Henry now. Yes, can't quite work out whether Henry's upside down or what. But you get these interesting sort of takes on London and its skyline, which I think... Of course, the view is fantastic, there's no doubt about that, but in a way, it sort of adds a different flavour and a level to it.
Shall we peer out at a particularly interesting bit? Where would be the best vantage point to get a glimpse of your work?
So at the moment, we're looking down towards Pudding Mill Lane DLR station.
Oh, before you go on, Pudding Mill Lane, do you happen to know the provenance of the name?
I don't, I'm afraid, no. It's a wonderful name, it's a fantastic name.
Pudding factory? No, surely there can't be such a thing.
Well, there could well have been. I just don't know. I mean, for example, this part of London is, as I said earlier, very rich in history. So over to our right, there's a sort of brick-built, warehousey-looking building. That used to be the Bryant & May match factory.
Is that the one with the two sort of watchtowers coming
in? It is, yes. So, again, a very historic, you know, many people will know Bryant & May matches, or I think they may still exist, I don't know, but that's where they used to make them, and there are all sorts of stories about, rather unfortunate stories actually, about people who used to make the matches and dip them in the phosphorus to make them burn, and of course that didn't do very good things to them in those days. So that's a sort of example of the past here, but very important building.
Well, to tie that into another episode that will either just have aired or just be about to air, we're going to be examining the skulls of victims of phosphorus poisoning.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, well, there you go. Yes.
So there's a bizarre tie-in.
Below us is one of the canals, which runs, part of the canal network in this part of London. We've got the Greenway, which is the walkway which runs through this part of London. You can see people walking on it now. We built this greeny yellow building below us called the View Tube, which is a great place to come and get a coffee, but also there's art exhibitions and such like there. And then right below us is a new lawn which we've just installed, which is going to be an events lawn. I believe it's capable of holding about 20,000 people when it's completely full. The idea is that we can have, you know, some quite serious events below the orbit there, which would be a great place to have them. In the distance, in fact, just on the other side of the railway, which is the railway which runs from Liverpool Street out to Essex and Suffolk, you can see some of the allotments we've just built with their sheds on, which are replacements for the allotments which we had to move pre-games.
That's very interesting. That they should be sort of reinstated. How have they been allocated?
Well, there is an allotment society and called Manor Gardens Allotment Society, and we've worked with them over the years to replace the allotments that they have. So we have some of them in the South Park down here.
Because there was, of course, a lot of displacement that was attendant on the games landing here, and although ostensibly it was pretty much derelict land, there were a number of small businesses and workshops and scraps of playground and bits and pieces like that. So it does sound as though the responsibility to those individuals, you know, it's not as though they've just been swamped or shoved out entirely. They've been accommodated.
No, I'm not au fait with the full history, but largely they have been accommodated, I believe. For example, where the stadium is now, there was a salmon smokery called Foreman's, and Foreman's still exists. It's just been moved a few hundred metres in one direction, and I think it still supplies Fortnum & Mason's with smoked salmon.
Yes, just on the other side of the canal, I believe. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Well, let's mooch around a little bit. We're passing by another of the mirrors. That's a very disconcerting effect. Never has reality seemed so artificial.
Well, yes, and looking in mirrors, yes, not a good idea sometimes, but anyway.
I must say, it's very, very peaceful up here. I don't know, we've got a really gorgeous day to be looking out at London.
It's
but
a beautiful day,
there's
yes.
also something about the sense of the bowl of the city. We can see the various hills around it, and it feels suddenly a much smaller place in a very pleasant way, actually.
I think what's so great about getting up to places like this, and I guess you can do it in other towers in London and other high places, but you're quite right. Of course, London, when you're on the ground, feels sort of flat, if you like, but up here you can really see the landscape, the topography, and how, in a sense, London sort of sits within it, as you say.
It starts to feel like a town in some bizarre way, doesn't
almost,
it?
Yes.
As opposed to just an endless... Yeah. Well, we're going to head outside, and it's probably an opportune moment to get a word from our sponsor.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to a CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
Well, we've tried a couple of exits out onto the balcony running around the outside of that cylindrical room, and the one we've just used brings us straight out to overlook the main stadium. It's denuded of a lot of the trappings and trimmings, gone are the light towers, and in fact, I think you were saying it looks a lot like it did just before the games.
Well, in reality, no, of course, but basically the stadium is now turned back into a construction site, is being transformed into, you know, what will be a football stadium and an athletic stadium and a great place for rugby and concerts as well. So it's becoming the multifunctional sort of venue that it needs to be.
And coming on from the comment I made just before the break about the way it foreshortens London, we can see distantly the velodrome, and that makes me realise just how blooming big this park is.
It is. I always remember that there were drawings that showed the park, and they had a scale on, and the scale basically was Oxford Street, because if you walk from the south of the park to the north, it's about the length of Oxford Street from one end to the other. So quite long. In fact, the whole parklands, or the whole site, if you like, including the venues, is about 2.5 square kilometres in size.
You've got to be a fit man for this job.
I've done a lot of... You know, the thing is, not so long ago, I put a little app on my phone which
works out how many steps I'd taken. And I wish I'd done that in 2007. I didn't have the phone, so I couldn't have the app. But if I had, I would have loved to have seen, you know, whether I'd got to the moon and back or something. I don't know.
If I overheard you correctly, and one should never overhear people, I'm looking up now and I can see, oh, I don't know, it must be 50 feet further up the top of the tower. Are you planning to go up there?
Well, not all the way up to the top, not right to the red ring you can see above there. That would test my courage to an extreme. But no, you can go a little bit further. It's not publicly accessible, but there are climb and walkways because you get fantastic views, and I wanted to get some shots looking down upon the park.
Well, tell me about what we can see here, and I'll just give a little description that we've either a river or a canal. I'm going to say a canal. Well, in fact, there are two that I can see, and they seem to join and lead off my 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. We've got the media centre there, I know what that is, the velodrome on the far side there, the stadium, of course, to my 10 and 11 o'clock. And what else is your eye seeing that mine isn't?
OK, so yes, you're absolutely correct. So we've got the stadium, then we've got one of the a canal, part of the canal system around here. And incidentally, I should say that the canal system, which prior to games was clogged and impassable, certainly by boat, and largely disappeared, is now being cleaned up. And in the future, you'll be able to get on a boat if you so wish, potentially, if boats do this, and go all the way, for example, up to Regent's Park on a canal. So they're all connected. And on the right-hand side is the River Lee, and you can see the River Lee snaking through the centre of the park, on up through Hackney Marshes, and ultimately up the Lee Valley into the distance. What we're seeing, really, in front of us with the River Lee at its centre is the main parkland. In the north, you can see the A12 with a bus going over it at the moment and a coach. Beyond that is an area called Eton Manor, which during games was used largely for athletes to warm up, but is now being transformed into a fantastic new hockey and tennis centre for London.
Is that the... Now, I don't think you're talking about that, but is that expanse of what looks like grass there, really?
No.
Enormous area? What's
that? That's the... that was during games the International Broadcast Centre, but is now being turned into a sort of tech startup hub. Also... I think British Telecom have their broadcast centre there.
Yes, no, I mean the... That's very interesting about all the startups, sure, actually. Yes. But beyond that, we see a right line of trees, and then we've got green there.
Well, that's East Marsh, as it's called. In fact, that part of the largest, I believe, could be wrong, so someone will probably tell me if I'm wrong, part of the largest area of football fields, I think, in Europe, in one place. And lots of football happens there. But no, over slightly to the right, and it's difficult to see. You can see a little orange bridge in the distance, which crosses Rockholt Road, and Eton Manor is just over there. This side of Eton Manor and this side of the A12 is what we call the North Park, or what I've tended to call the North Park, because it's north of the centre of the park. That's the more green and biodiverse area. We've got a lot of habitat there. You can see the River Lee running through it, and we've got a large area in the centre of wetland planting, which we call a wetland bowl. It's quite beautiful. It's a lovely place to go to. It's very calm and peaceful. It's also a great place for birds to nest and for other forms of habitat. Wasn't there before games. But also it performs an important function in that when we have very heavy rainfall, that whole area is designed to flood. The reeds disappear underwater, and in doing that, it actually protects over 5,000 properties upriver from flooding. And I think this is a very good example of how you can use landscape in particular to mitigate the effects of heavy rainfall, something, of course, which recently has been very much in the headlines.
I wonder what lessons you've learnt from opening up various parts of the park to the public about the impact that having people arrive here in this new way has on the park.
Well, I think it's, in some respects, it's early days. Of course, we've had some very big events in the park, big concerts, various other sorts of things. I think that what I've learnt, which is encouraging, is that the park is pretty robust. For example, I was lucky enough to be able to come in here during games when, at its height, we had 250,000 people in the park. and come in here a week after games or so and take some photographs, and the most extraordinary thing is you would never have known anything ever happened. And I think that's testament to the way the park has been built and designed, and to the great team of people who helped put it all together.
That must be very gratifying. That's one clear way of endorsing your choices, right?
Absolutely. I think it is. And it's a great endorsement of the design and of the way that it was built and the real workmanship that went into it, if you like. Great team of people, as I say. I think it'll be very interesting. In the south of the park, where we are here in the orbit, we're looking down upon... you can see an area where there are some pine trees, some interesting looking sticky things coming out the ground, some red paving. If you look down...
Yes, what's all that about? That looks like where you would put traitors' heads if it was further towards London Bridge.
I hope not. This is a very new part of the park, not as yet open, and this is the bit that opens on the 5th of April. It's been totally changed from where we were at Games. During Games, this whole area below us was paved, necessarily so, because of the large numbers of people that I mentioned coming in and out of the park. But we really felt that, on a bleak February morning, it wouldn't be a place that anybody would want to linger. So we commissioned a design competition and had many entries, but we chose an entry from an American practice, actually, of landscape architects called James Corner Field Operations. In fact, James Corner himself actually trained in this country, so he's an Englishman who went over to the States and set up a practice and works there. The interesting thing about his team and his design is that it's really created a series of spaces which can be used for all sorts of different purposes during the day and the night. So we have great play areas, we have an amphitheatre space, we have an outdoor theatre, we have an amazing water feature, which if you look down below us, you can see this sort of what looks like a squiggle in the ground, which is... hundreds of jets of water which we can play with and create this amazing play feature for London. So we really have this incredibly dynamic sort of place for people to come and play, to eat, to picnic, to have events in, to get wet, do all sorts of stuff, which we think is going to really lift the nature of this place.
I've got probably the most boring question that I could could drum up here, but I'm asking because I'm interested. What in terms of the challenges that you faced throughout this project, and maybe they're the challenges offered by the land itself, or perhaps externally, I'm not sure. What's been the big one?
Well, I think that's a very good question.
Is it really?
It is a very good question. Well, I think. Well, for example, the challenge here was to do a lot with a very challenging part of London, as we've mentioned before, an area which was polluted, which had all sorts of issues, and to get it done on time and on budget, if you like, for Games and indeed now for transformation. So, for example, the 2 years following Games, we built almost as much landscape as we did before Games, but in half the amount of time. So we've had to work very, very hard in a very focused way to get that to happen. The challenge is, and I think this is the same with all projects like this and many smaller ones, is getting people to work successfully together in many ways. If you get people to work successfully together and you have the right sort of team members, if you like, then the technical challenges become less of an issue. You can find your way around them.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the people that I've run into who are connected with the Legacy organisation so far on the way to the interview, some office bugs, some people on site, have all spoken in really warm terms about you. And clearly part of your job must be watching the clock and looking at the clipboard and so forth. So that must be quite a challenge, personally, in terms of your management style, to keep everybody happy and smiling, but bringing things in on time.
Well, my view is that, yes, of course, I'm responsible for getting it built and making it happen on time and on budget, but the best way, my view, to do that is to have a great team which works together. If you've got a team which works together, which collaborates, which says yes, we've got it wrong, what can we do, or there's a problem here, or whatever, then there's usually a way to solve it, and to get, most importantly for me, you know, when people walk away from this project and they finished it, to feel proud of what they've done, that they've created a unique new part of London, which is going to be here, you know, for all intents and purposes forever.
Are you going to be here for all intents and purposes forever? Or is there a point where your work here is done?
Well, I'm going to be here for a bit longer. We'll see what happens. I carry on my work. We have other projects which need to be built on site. For example, in fact, looking ahead of us, you can see the combined heat and power plant, the CHP plant, which is that rusty coloured building with the red stairs and the chimney. That's the piece of kit, if you like, which delivers all of the energy for the park.
That looks deceptively old school.
It's a fantastically modern piece of sustainable power generation. But beyond that, and along the Lee navigation, the canal that you can see there, where we are creating a new parkland, which will really help knit Hackney Wick and Hackney into the park. So one of the things which we really want to do is to bring this totally new and for many people unexplored part of London, and to really link it closely to these historic and important lived-in parts of London, so people can feel, you know, this is not an imposition. It's a great new opportunity.
You know, what we haven't touched on so far is housing, and I know that there is much talk of housing. Where is this housing?
So,
where is this housing going to be?
Well, some of it, in a sense, is already here. If you look off into the distance, so you can see the velodrome, and slightly to the right of the velodrome, you can see what during games was the Athletes' Village. The Athletes' Village is now being turned into residential apartments, 50% of which will be affordable and 50% which will be privately let. So a good mix there. To the left of that, you can see a sort of construction site, really, between that and the velodrome. That's Chobham Manor, which is the first bit of housing which will be built on the park. It's primarily family housing. It's already on site. I believe the first people will be moving in perhaps even sometime next year. So that's a real sign of, you know, we haven't stopped after games. We're motoring, if you like.
And when we talk about housing, we're talking about blocks.
We're talking a mixture of housing. We're talking about houses with gardens, and we're talking about apartments as well.
Now, it seems as though there's not much evidence so far of houses. Is that, are they going to be later additions?
No, there will be houses over there. So the north of the park really is seen as the great place to put housing around. It's a beautiful park and landscape setting, great place for people to come. In fact, difficult to see perhaps from where we are here on the orbit, but between what was the Athletes' Village and the velodrome, just slightly to the left, there's a small dark coloured building which is the North Park cafeteria and restaurant. It's called the Timber Lodge, and also associated with that is the most fantastic natural play area, where children can climb and can swing and can do water play, and so you can imagine that when that housing is built and occupied, it'd be a great place for families to come out to.
I wanted to say something about Hackney Wick, actually. There's a rumour going around that Hackney Wick station is to be moved. Do you know anything about this?
Well, I know that we're doing work on Hackney Wick station, but I must confess my ignorance in that, because I really genuinely don't have much to do with it, or anything at all. My mind has been rather focused on the park.
Yes, you've got one or two things to think about here.
Things to do, yes.
I wonder if we can move away completely from the park, which is a strange thing to say as we look down upon it. Yes. Because you, I think, may have knowledge of London's other parks, and I wondered if we could just visit a few of those through your knowledge.
Well, in a way, I mean, you know, London, as I think I mentioned earlier, is famous for its parks. It's got these fantastic historic London parks, Richmond Park, Hyde Park, of course, Kew Gardens, which isn't really a park, but a botanic gardens. It has an incredibly rich history of green space and parklands. And, of course, many of those parklands were built as a response to social issues and pressures. In many ways, the original Victorian parks were seen as important for public health. They were places to let the air breathe when people thought that some of the various illnesses and sicknesses are a result of smog and smoke and things which we perhaps suffer from less nowadays. So London has this really rich history of great open spaces and green spaces. The interesting thing is that a few years ago, an exercise was done in London which looked at what we call green grids. What are all, if you take all the bits of greenery in London, the green spaces, the parks, the squares, the pocket parks and gardens and things, and start to think about how can you link those together? How can you create a network of green space? Great places for people to walk between and cycle between, etc. So, for example, this particular park, Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park, sits within that sort of map and network, and lots of the work that we're doing creating new links out to the hinterland and adjacent communities are about making that green grid happen, making green connections for cyclists and people work throughout London. So ultimately you have this sort of urban network of green spaces.
So the creation of those parks that you're talking about, we know there was a big philanthropic vibe going on in the Victorian era. The creation of spaces like this, and the maybe even the cleaning up of the river, setting up of cycle routes and so forth, are they coming, do you feel, from the same sort of impulse, or are they being arrived at through a subtly different set of impulses?
I think in many ways it's the same. Interestingly enough, I think it's the same sort of impulse, perhaps with a slightly different end in mind, but that's only because we know now more about the benefits of green space. So, for example, we know that, as I've mentioned before, it's good for health and good for people's psychological well-being. But we also know that good quality green space attracts employers and businesses, because, you know, you've only got to go to Canary Wharf, not far from us here, and see what the public spaces there are like on a summer's day when it's thronged with people having their lunch, etc. So we know that's important as a creator of business and employment. We also know that for developers, it's an important destination, if you like. So it encourages people to come to this part of London, which perhaps a few years ago would not really have been known or written off, you know, as a not a destination. So it creates the destination, it encourages business opportunities, it does all these different things. And of course, for the people who live around here, it's a fantastic place to be able to come on a sunny summer's afternoon.
We're close to the end of our time here, and I've really enjoyed what you've had to say, and doing so in such wonderful surroundings as well, surroundings being the right word, particularly on this occasion. We are, as we speak, a little under a month away until the opening. How are things looking from your perspective?
I think they're looking good. You know, it's always at this point in a project, and I remember exactly the same thing before the Olympic Games, when people come around and they say, "You're never going to finish, are you?" Or, "Well, this looks a little bit tricky to me." So, yeah, there's a bit of a battle, but perfectly confident we'll get there. We've got, we've got a great team of people working on it. You know, the great thing is they're really proud of what they do, and they think it's really important to present this fantastic new place to London in April.
Well, it is very exciting, and all the best of luck as that date draws closer. For now, from the top of the Arsenal, are we calling it the Arsenal Mittal or the Orbit Tower? What do you prefer?
Because I can't pronounce the Arsenal Mittal very easily, I just stick to the Orbit.
There's something awful about that name, but yes, from atop the Orbit, they'll ask you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. My heart aches for
some far off place. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Dr. Phil Askew. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. My name, Quentin Wolfe.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.